This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest is Paul Goldberger, who is a contributing editor of Vanity Fair. From 1997 to 2011, he served as the architecture critic for The New Yorker, where he wrote the magazine's celebrated Skyline column. He also holds the Joseph Urban Chair in Design and Architecture at the New School in New York City. He was formerly dean of the Parsons School of Design, a division of the New School. He began his career at the New York Times, where he was architecture editor, and he won the Pulitzer Prize for Distinguished Criticism. He's the author of several books, most recently Why Architecture Matters and Building Up and Tearing Down, Reflections on the Age of Architecture. He is the 2015 Hitchcock Lecturer at Berkeley. Paul, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Where were you born and raised?
In New Jersey, actually. In suburban New Jersey, which is sort of a little odd when you think that I'm such a devoted urban person, such a city person. I grew up in Passaic, New Jersey, and grew up in a nearby town called Nutley, New Jersey, which is these days, I think, best known as the hometown also of Martha Stewart.
Aha!
Who I did not know growing up. She was. We went to the same high school, but I think I was in the third grade when she was in high school.
So. I see. And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
My father was trained as a teacher and then became an editor and publisher. And my mother was a teacher and speech therapist. So I grew up in a family that I guess you could say was certainly literate and cared about the written word. I've never figured out where my architecture side came from because they were not people with any background or unusual degree of interest in that world. But they were very much people who were interested in writing and literature and journalism and things like that. So the side of me that went in that direction very much came from them, and certainly clear communication was something I got from my father very much, who was a relentlessly sharp, smart editor. In fact, I remember when he died a few years ago giving a eulogy in which I said it's a shame that he's not here to edit all the comments today, because I'm sure all of us would end up 30% shorter if he were editing all this stuff. He was great at sort of taking out unnecessary things and teaching me that often you communicate most clearly in the simplest way.
And writing architecture criticism is very complicated, because
yes,
you want to be clear.
Right.
But at the same time, I noticed in some of your pieces that I've read that you really have to get into the complexity of the structure,
right,
and describe
right.
it so sure. people can visualize it.
Absolutely. Yes.
You write in one of your books about the importance of memory, and both of these towns that you mentioned, you believe, really shaped your maturation in a
sure.
way, as you saw the sort of the contradictions between mm-hmm. city and village. And talk a little about
sure.
that.
I was very lucky in so many ways, because the town I grew up in, this little town called Nutley, New Jersey, was not that far from New York City, so I was exposed to the city and that whole world. It was 10 miles away, but it was not just a bedroom suburb. Some people did commute. My father was a commuter into New York, but there were other people who worked in factories and stores and were very local, and for all it mattered to them, New York could have been 1,000 miles away, not 10 miles away. So I had some of the experience of a kind of self-contained small town and some of the experience of a metropolitan area. And I felt I grew up in both. And it was a very mixed, interestingly heterogeneous kind of town. There were kids who graduated from the public high school who went to Harvard and kids who went to the Army. And So there were all kinds of people there, which was really a great experience. It also, maybe most importantly, taught me a lot about physical fabric of a place. What made it really unusual is the fact that at the main intersection of the two main streets in this town was the high school football stadium. And across the street from it was the high school. The other side was the junior high school. The other side was the library, the bank, the town hall, the fire station. All of these things were kind of arranged in this little civic center. And it looked almost like what you would, the little plastic buildings you might put up if you had a train set or something. Mm-hmm. And make a little bit,
Or something from a movie.
Yeah. Exactly. And so it taught me a lot about symbols and towns and the fact that you could walk to and from all these places. I walked to school my entire career, even through high school. And then there was also a main street with all the shopping. And it really kind of worked. And I think it still sort of works. It's not changed all that much in all these years.
So this gave you that sense of the civic center, even though
Yes.
you're writing a lot about big cities.
Definitely.
But the life of the streets,
Yes.
even though this is a small town version.
Well, that's absolutely right. And in fact, whether it gave me a taste for bigger cities or made me realize the importance also of neighborhood and breaking things down
on
scale and community, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, we knew all our neighbors. I remember, you know, I can still picture the people who lived in the house on each side of us and across the street and so forth, and the walk to school.
You also describe in your book on why architecture matters your living situation. Mm-hmm. When you grew up, your grandparents were upstairs.
In the very first house I was growing up in.
Yeah.
In Passaic, New Jersey. Yes, we lived in a two-family house. What they would call in Chicago, I guess, a duplex or something. And my grandparents owned the house. They lived on the upper story. We lived on the lower story. And not only was there that closeness of family and community, but I remember as a little kid being very struck by the fact that the rooms looked the same because the configuration was identical above and below, but they also looked and felt completely different because my parents had very modern furniture and things were painted light colors and my grandparents had this sort of heavy old European furniture and the walls were dark and they were heavy damask draperies and all that stuff. And I don't know quite why and how I saw it, because there obviously was some instinct in me that made me receptive to this kind of observation. But I saw that these places were the same and yet different, and I began to think about what it meant. I don't know how conscious I was of it at the time either, mm-hmm. but as I thought back, it became a very important memory, just as when we moved to our own house in this nearby town called Nutley. It was sort of a bigger single family, sort of vaguely Queen Anne, Victorian sort of house. And it did have a certain kind of, you know, presence that the other house hadn't. And I began to feel that. The other thing I really took from that town I grew up in was a sense that public space was a big part of the place. That you didn't feel, if you lived in a private single family house, that you were in an enclave separated from the world, the way people often do today, behind gates, behind hedges. You know, every house was open. Nobody had a front yard that wasn't sort of open and visible as you walked down the street. Two blocks away was a park, which led to another park, which led eventually to the center of town with all the stuff I was describing. And so the public realm, you could say, played a huge role in the way that little town was shaped, which is very different from most suburbs, which are really much more about private space.
Where were you educated then?
I went to the public high school in Nutley, New Jersey, and then went to Yale. So I went to New Haven, Connecticut, which was the farthest away I'd ever lived at that time, actually.
And at Yale, both in your studies, I gather, and in the setting,
right?
You move further along in this direction
Absolutely.
Of doing architecture.
Yes,
talk
yes.
a little
sure,
about that.
Sure.
So first the setting.
Yeah, I had begun through high school to become quite interested in architecture. And I wasn't sure I wanted to become an architect, but I knew it was going to play a role in my life somehow because I just cared about it and responded to it. And I had seen in magazines these very interesting new modern buildings at Yale, which they'd built in the 50s and 60s, quite a lot of unusually important buildings. Those first got me interested in going there, actually. And when I was lucky enough to be, in fact, to get in and be able to go, I arrived and had a very strange experience, which is that I saw these buildings that I'd been reading about and seeing in magazines, and I actually liked them and found some of them quite exciting. But then there was all this other stuff, this old-fashioned sort of pseudo-Gothic architecture, much of it from the 1920s. And I really liked that, too. And, of course, if you were serious about architecture, you weren't supposed to like that stuff because it was fake. Let's put that in quotes. It was fake, quote, fake. And the really serious, authentic stuff were the modern buildings. So how come these buildings were so pleasurable? How come they felt so good? How come I liked them so much? And so a lot of my time there was sort of a quest to try to reconcile these two things. Maybe it's a quest I'm still working on because I still like both traditional and modern architecture, and I've never felt comfortable putting myself totally on one side or the other of that line.
This must have sensitized you to this historical dimension, which is very important in your writing, that part of the context of a building is the history of the building and in the history of the surroundings.
Absolutely. You know, a building is almost never an isolated object. It's not a piece of sculpture. It's not like this water bottle where, you know, only the shape matters. Sculptural shape is part of what architecture is, but it's only a part. And every building is shaped also by its context, has to respond to its context. We, in turn, understand it through the context in part. And at Yale, again, I learned all kinds of lessons about that. I mean, I saw how some buildings responded very much to their context. Others did not and really were more assertively purely sculptural. And also how those old buildings kind of formed a context. They made an urban fabric. They made a larger place than any individual building can make. You know, the fundamental architectural idea of a city is that the whole is more than the sum of the parts. And I think I began through all these places to sort of figure that out viscerally for myself, that the whole is more than the sum of the parts.
In retrospect, do you think a place like Yale would be different than a place like Berkeley because of the private funding, the private endowment that makes it what it is? Private money making possible
setting. Right. That's an interesting question. I mean, Yale is certainly different from Berkeley. Whether private money is the factor or whether it's East versus West, public institution in terms of management, not just money, and private institution, which also has more freedom.
So layer upon layer.
Right. There are many, many differences. All that said, you know, I mean, they're both truly great universities with enormous reach and scope to them and depth and complexity as institutions. And none of them are ones that you can easily characterize. Probably the most important difference, though, is scale. I mean, Yale, while it's big compared to a small liberal arts college, is small compared to a place like Berkeley. And so that, I think scale was one of the things that helped. Just as, in fact, growing up in a not-so-big city, in a sort of small town-type city, helped me understand certain things that might have been harder to see in a huge place initially. And then I could apply what I learned in a huge place. Similarly, Yale was big enough to have all this stuff that taught me all these lessons, and yet not so gargantuan that as a freshman coming in, you're kind of overwhelmed by it.
At Yale, who were your intellectual mentors?
My most important intellectual mentor was Vincent Scully, the great architectural history professor who is actually still alive. He's 94, living in retirement in Virginia now, but still around. He was an especially meaningful mentor to me, I think. But there were others as well. I had a wonderful city planning professor named Alex Garvin, who is also still around, who is a planner in New York, who had gone to Yale and taught part-time there and has done so, well, for more than 40 years, because I was his student 40 years ago, and he continues to do that, in fact, yeah.
So under these and probably others, how did your thinking about architecture mature as a kind of a stepping stone to becoming an architectural critic? I mean, did you from one of your lectures that I read, you really learned that you could have both passion and but also be critical at the same time?
I think that was one thing I very much attributed to Vincent Scully, mm-hmm. Who was a particularly passionate and emotive and emotional scholar. Mm-hmm. And learning that, in fact, feeling and intellectual perception are not mutually exclusive. And that, in fact, one must try to integrate those two things rather than deny one side or the other. And that, in fact, we can have, I think his term at one point was, we can have both empathetic and associative relationships with buildings. Associative meaning through ideas and other kinds of intellectual connections, empathetic through feelings. And that was absolutely true. The other thing I took from my education in those days that I was important because it is something that every young person has to learn, I think, is that there are no ideologies that really answer all questions, that in fact, none of them are really right. And when you're young, you tend to sort of fall prey often to belief systems and total thought systems that provide answers. I learned as a student to be suspicious of all of them. Which is not to say that they're all nonsense, but it's to say that at the end of the day, you will do far better if you don't count on one to give you everything you know, but take the best from various things and try to synthesize. That Jane Jacobs, to quote an important, cite an important influence for me and so many other people in those days, is mostly right. But not 100% right, and doesn't explain everything. That her opponents may have been wrong about many, many things, and wrong about her, but not wrong about everything else. And that sometimes, to stay on Jane Jacobs for a moment, she was famous as an opponent of Robert Moses, and most of the time correct in her opposition of Moses. That didn't mean that every single thing Moses ever did was wrong. Similarly, Lewis Mumford, the great architectural critic who was another important influence for me, was also a very eloquent and longstanding opponent of Moses. But he and Jacobs didn't agree at all, and in fact, they disagreed about what was wrong with Robert Moses, even though they were his two most famous and articulate opponents. And so you realize it's not a simple black and white situation. It's everybody's a various shade of gray, and you try to navigate through them and learn what you can from both of them and then figure out what you believe in yourself.
In your book, and I'm reminded of it right now, you talk about buildings as being serving a function, but also having the potential to be art.
Yes.
And so that you, in a way, you're this recognition of the importance of function, mm-hmm. grounds you in a kind of practicality.
Yes.
That makes what you just said.
Yes,
about,
but it's never only that.
No, right.
Right, but that's exactly the point. But for me, it's never a matter of either or.
Right.
It's both and. that in fact, architecture is not art or function and practicality. That whole argument, that whole dialectic is fundamentally wrong, because in fact, the most important thing to know about architecture is that it's both of those things connected, and it's that any successful work of architecture has both a functional and an aesthetic component, and we have to sort of understand and respect both and judge both. I mean, it may succeed on one level and fail on another. It might fail on both levels. It might succeed on both levels, but it has some degree, it's both.
I like to ask my guests, what are the skills and temperament required for the career that they've chosen as advice for students? And one of the senses I'm getting from you is that doing architecture criticism involves complexity.
Yes, I think it does. It involves complexity and a willingness to see the world in this way that I've described as both and rather than either or. Definitely does that. I think it involves a desire to communicate and an ability to communicate clearly. But if we can take a step back from that, it's about sharing your passions in certain ways. And I mean, I love architecture. I love sharing with other people what it means to me. And I love fighting for better architecture, which is what criticism is at least partly trying to do.
So it's about ideas.
Yes.
Passion about ideas, mm-hmm. and about structures, but also a mission of being an educator.
I think it is. It's interesting you say that, because I've always felt that. And I see the two different parts of my career, because I also spend part of my life as an academic and part of my life as a journalist, as reinforcing each other, not as entirely separate.
As a critic, you're not primarily a theoretician,
That's
although
right.
you know the theory.
Yes.
And I think at some point you wrote that a theorist wouldn't necessarily make a good critic, although he could be.
I think that's absolutely right. And yes, I appreciate you noticing that little sentence buried down there somewhere, yeah. because it's absolutely right. I think, in fact, sometimes a theorist is a poorer critic, because if a theorist really believes in his or her theory, then they believe in a much narrower realm of possibility, let's say, and would be inclined to discount what fell outside of their theory. Well, an awful lot of the world is inevitably going to fall outside of any theory. And does that mean you reject all of it and ignore it as a critic because it doesn't fit within, or you criticize it only for not conforming to your theory? Well, at that point, criticism becomes pretty meaningless, because all it is an evaluation of whether or not a particular work falls under this relatively narrow umbrella or whatever. I don't think that's a viable way to write criticism.
And what about temperament as a critic? One thing that I'm hearing you say is you have to maintain your sensibility to the wow moment.
Yes.
Gee whiz, you know. So there's a childlike quality there of seeing something for the first time with awe.
I hope so. I mean, I think I've always been a critic with enthusiasm. I don't want my enthusiasm ever to cloud my judgment. I mean, I don't. I hope I'm sophisticated enough not to say wow to junk, but nevertheless, I think if you don't bring some degree of enthusiasm and love to the subject, you can't be a good critic. Doesn't mean, again, that you love individual things you're writing about. I should hope you're critical enough not to love most of them, but that you love the field in general and the ideas behind it and the greatest experiences that you might get from it. And that you have curiosity. You know, I think to continue to be curious is the most important way not to become old and stale. really, actually. And as you get older, that's harder in some ways, because there's always a sense that you don't realize it till you get older, but you are very stamped by something in your brain is very stamped by everything that was going on when your career began. I mean, I remember thinking that when I was a young critic and observing how much interest Ada Louise Huxtable, the first architecture critic at the New York Times and a woman who was an extraordinary writer and journalist and critic and the mentor to so many of us, myself included. Ada Louise still seemed very much enthralled to I.M. Pei and Edward Larrabee Barnes and a lot of modern architects who came of age in the 1950s as she did. And you sort of often continue to dance to the music that was playing when you first arrived, even as you do evolve and see new things and understand them. My point is only that one has to make a greater and greater effort to stay connected and be curious, really.
Help us understand how you do your work even as you're changing over time. Mm-hmm. So in other words, when you're looking at a new building, mm-hmm. you obviously know the other buildings that architect
sure,
has done,
sure.
but you're trying to relate it to the history of architecture in
right.
a way. Yeah.
Right.
And
well, I've just written, just the other day, I had occasion to write something about the new Whitney Museum by Renzo Piano that is opening next week in New York. It was a interesting case study in a way because it required knowing something about museums in general, something about the specific history of the Whitney Museum, particularly its Marcel Breuer building on the Upper East Side of New York, which it was vacating to go to this new building. It required knowing about Renzo Piano's other work, which was entirely relevant. And it required knowing something about the physical setting of this museum, which is next to the High Line, the new elevated park in the Chelsea section of Manhattan near the Hudson River. It's a very important and changing context in a different part of the city. So I was in a lucky situation there because all those things were things I knew and had been thinking about for a long time. But if I hadn't been, I would have had to have gotten up to speed on all of those things to evaluate that building properly and to really get all the issues that appropriately should be raised in a discussion of it. I mean, it has to be evaluated, again, in terms of, you know, how does it work for the display of art? How does it feel as you were a visitor going through it? How does it feel if you're just walking by and not going into it? What does it say on all these levels?
And in addition, because a building is being built at a particular time
right.
with political constraints,
mm-hmm.
financial constraints,
yes.
A whole array of problems that essentially have to be integrated in your analysis,
yes.
even if you don't write about them.
Absolutely. You have to know all that stuff and understand it to evaluate the building properly, which does not mean that you have to forgive certain things because of it. It just means you have to know. And, I mean, if a building took a particular shape for a political reason, because it was forced, the architect was forced to by the city planners or by the zoning laws. That's one thing that you need to know. That doesn't mean, as I said, therefore it's okay, but you need to know that it was not just an arbitrary and whimsical decision. However, maybe something else was an arbitrary and whimsical decision, and you can't evaluate it properly without knowing. On the other hand, it's also important to remember that an explanation is not an excuse. And so to be able to explain something is not necessarily to say, therefore, it's okay because I know why and how it happened that way.
And so as you write a review, how long does it take you to do that? I mean, do you and also do you go to the building twice several times to reinforce whatever impressions you're getting?
Sure. I try to go to a building multiple times. I try to spend, I almost always will walk through it with the architect or the client, depending on who's available, or both, to hear what they asked for, what they thought they were getting. Again, doesn't mean I necessarily agree with it, but I want to hear what they believed they were doing, and not necessarily to use their good efforts as an excuse for accepting things that I don't feel are adequate. But nevertheless, it's important to know what they thought they were doing, what they wanted to do, what they set out to do. If it's a building like a museum, where I can put myself in the experience of the user, because I go to museums, I know what it's like to look at art, and so forth, that makes it a little bit easier. There are other kinds of buildings where it's important to talk to the people who use them, because they may see things that I don't see necessarily.
So a consumer of sports.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Now, I actually am interested in sports, and so, but nevertheless, I've never, I sit in the stands, I've never been on the field playing baseball in a baseball park. It's important to sort of know how it works at all levels. A hospital, it's important to see it from a patient's perspective most of all, but also from the perspective of those people who work with it every day. And sometimes those things take research. Now, it's also true that all buildings evolve and change over time, as do our perceptions of them. I've often thought it would actually be very good if architecture critics could make a habit of revisiting buildings, let's say 5 years after they were finished, and reevaluating them. I think we would sometimes find that our original views were right, and we would sometimes find that our original views were off base, that we missed something, that 5 years of human life have changed things in a certain way and maybe made some things work better, maybe shown that other things were a mistake. So I wish we could do more of that, actually. We don't, not because there's any policy against it. It's just journalism is hard these days. It's under greater pressure than ever. It's hard to do much architecture criticism at all. And it's harder still to take time to do things that are not viewed as essential. And, of course, the public is understandably wants to know about new things because they're new. And then it gets hard to go back and look at older ones, but we absolutely should. Ideally, we would be doing that.
An example of that you talk about in your book, which is the modern addition to the Louvre, mm-hmm. which you
yes.
didn't like. What was it that changed your thinking, going back to it again and again?
Sure. Impé's glass pyramid, that is, it's the entrance to the Louvre, I thought was an inappropriate intervention of modern architecture into this very traditional precinct and a degree of change that was not appropriate for it. And I was wrong. I'm very happy to admit that I was wrong on that one. It was built. The world did not collapse. The Louvre actually got somewhat better. It, in fact, respected the classical order of the Louvre better than I had given it credit for being. And I've also become much more sympathetic in recent years to really good modern additions to historic buildings. I've just finished working on a book with the architect Norman Foster, who has made something of a specialty of doing works of that type that is called Building with History, that is about very sort of assertively modern buildings that are juxtaposed next to or are often additions to historic buildings that respect the historic building, but not in the obvious way of mimicking it in any way, but by being modern, but by taking cues and doing certain subtle things that show that great attention was being paid and great respect was being shown to the older building, but just in a way different from imitating its architectural style. And certainly the Impé pyramid at the Louvre was a good example of that. He understood that original building and respected it totally. He just didn't follow its architectural style in any literal way. And as time went on, it became very clear that he was right, and the critics who had doubted whether it was a good idea, like me, were wrong. In fact, I'm always very willing to admit when I'm wrong. I hope it isn't too often that it happens, but when it does, I think one is honor bound to say so.
You make the point that as a critic, you have a set of values and principles on the one hand, but you distinguish how you have to approach the architect and his intentions.
Right.
And at that point, you have to, well, what were his problems?
Right.
And how reasonable how reasonable is his solution
exactly.
to those problems, which
right.
is essentially drawing on all this complexity that we've been talking about. Talk a little about that, because my guess is that you are in your own values politically and socially are on the liberal side of the equation, but you're really willing to respect the architect for responding to the situation he was presented with and the problem.
An architect has no choice but to respond to a situation he's presented with. If the situation he's presented with is unacceptable, then the architect should resign. In other words, if it cannot yield a building that he or she feels they can stand behind, rather than producing a bad building, the architect should step aside. And I think it's important to understand intentions when we're in the realm of much more normal, conventional buildings, not buildings that raise some ethical issue, but just regular, everyday buildings. But to understand is not necessarily to accept. I think if I've made any mistake as a critic or had any weakness as a critic over the years, it's that I've sometimes given too much credit to good intentions, actually. Because most architects have good intentions. Very few architects approach a problem and say, okay, how can I design a really horrible building that is going to offend the client, offend the public, and fail to function? You know, not terribly often do they start out that way. So the intentions are usually good. And it's the critic's job to understand the intentions, but also to go beyond them. Because if the critic is limited by the architect's intentions, then he or she is not bringing anything really smart and meaningful into the discourse.
You say at one point, architecture can never be wholly divorced from politics. We've been talking a little about that, but this is really especially true when the building is of symbolic importance,
sure.
where politics is raised to a higher level. We're thinking here of the Vietnam Memorial, the 9/11 Memorial, the recent debate about an Eisenhower Memorial. Talk a little about that, because what in the end is the end result always? Well, did people wind up liking it, even in the process that there was much opposition of
right,
putting
right,
the design
right.
on the table?
Well, you raised three really important and compelling examples. They're a little bit different. The Vietnam Memorial is an extraordinary work, and I think one of the great works of the late 20th century. It was attacked at the beginning by some people who felt that it was excessively abstract and would not be able to adequately represent the feelings and the anguish of the families who had lost people in the war. We have seen, in fact, that the opposite was true, that it, in fact, spoke powerfully to people, and that the representational statue of soldiers that was placed on the grounds as part of the memorial as a way of placating the opposition, that's what actually seems now to be superfluous and mawkish and not very communicative at all. Thankfully, under pressure from Maya Lin, the designer, who was not able to prevent its inclusion totally, nevertheless, it was pushed somewhat to the side so it doesn't directly interfere with the experience of being at the wall itself that is the central part of that memorial. The 9/11 memorial, I think, is also quite successful, actually, and both of them together are reminders that it is possible to create a somewhat abstract, simple form that is not directly representational, that in fact does communicate to a lot of people and that speaks to everyone in a profound and moving and beautiful way and is appropriate to its particular site. Each of these are. You know, the Vietnam Memorial, it's not just that V-shaped wall. It's the subtlety of how the wall points to the Lincoln Memorial with one point, one direction, and toward the Washington Monument and the Capitol in the other, and how it subtly goes down and you sort of move away from the earth and then you return and have this sense of resurrection almost as you come back up to that. It is extraordinarily powerful. Similarly, at the 9/11 memorial, because those squares are the footprints of the towers, the power of the place, the power of that specific design in that specific place, joins with the power of the abstract form to be very, very important. Eisenhower now is another story altogether. That's a design by Frank Gehry, a great architect in my view, not one noted for memorials or public buildings in Washington. It's been very controversial, partly because the family of Eisenhower, many members of the family of Eisenhower, are not fond of it. They have found common cause with a group of very conservative architects and activists who are fighting the memorial because it is not classical, it is not traditional, it doesn't look like the Lincoln Memorial or what have you. I think they're wrong. I think the memorial is a strong design, and I hope it gets built. And it's very, very honest in its tribute to Eisenhower. I mean, they're saying crazy things about Gehry trying to destroy Eisenhower's reputation and suggesting that all is chaos because the stones don't line up right and so forth. That's just Philistine, basically, I think.
And politics.
And politics, exactly, yeah. Cultural politics as much as political politics. Politically, Frank Gehry has said to me that he, in fact, one of the reasons he's wanted to do this is because the more he learns about Eisenhower, the more he admires him, the more impressed he is at what Eisenhower stood for. And frankly, this country could benefit, I think, a little bit from a little more Eisenhower, which I never thought I would be saying. But, you know, Eisenhower actually said, we have to recognize that every warplane, every bomber we build is that many more children going hungry, that many more people going without clothing, that many more people not being educated, that many more people not being housed. Can you imagine? A Democrat wouldn't dare say that today, let alone a Republican. And the fact that a Republican president of the United States said that in a speech to the nation, amazing to think. So, in fact, it's a very good moment to honor Eisenhower. And I think the political argument against the memorial is cultural politics. It's about Frank Gehry's aesthetic and about how some people believe that you can only use a classical architectural language to memorialize somebody and honor the dead and so forth. And I don't believe that's true. And I think, in fact, the Vietnam Memorial and the 9/11 Memorial both show us otherwise.
In your writings on architecture, the notion of history and of time are very important. And I don't just mean the history of architecture.
Right, right.
I mean what time does mm-hmm. to a building, what time does to our appreciation of a building. Talk a little about that, because how do we get a handle on that? Do we just wait and see what time brings?
I think maybe we do just wait and see what time brings, except knowing that everything always changes, the relationship is always a dynamic one. It's not a static one. And multiple things are changing, because all of us as individuals are changing and growing, and our perceptions evolve somewhat over time. Culture at large is changing and growing. History is moving on, and that changes attitudes often. And then buildings themselves, of course, are not static, and they change. They change even if we don't try to change them, because if we leave them alone, they will deteriorate. They need tending to be kept the same, and sometimes we change them anyway. We overtly intervene and change them. So everything is changing all the time. That's why in the book Why Architecture Matters, I tried to separate out what I called architecture and memory, which is much more about our own personal histories and how they relate to buildings, and then buildings and time, which is much more a kind of broader sense of how architecture itself changes over time and how the culture views it differently at different times. To go back to the beginning of our conversation, when I talked about coming to Yale, in part because I loved the modern buildings there, and then discovering that the more traditional ones also appealed to me, that was an almost radical position for a student interested in architecture to have at that time. Now it wouldn't be anymore. Now I think it's widely understood how good those buildings were. And in fact, Yale is expanding with two new residential colleges that are being done in a traditional mode now, following the lead of those ones from 90 years ago. So the culture has evolved in a certain way. Some might say it has not evolved positively, and that it might have been better if Yale had commissioned someone who was more at the cutting edge to do that. I sort of felt that myself somewhat, but we'll see. Maybe these will turn out okay. I don't want to judge them yet until they exist.
Time also brings a change in the materials that are available.
Sure.
The technology.
I mean, from go back to Gothic cathedrals and flying buttresses. Architecture has always used the latest technology and demonstrated it, and that in turn has determined, you know, what we can build. Sure. And it all evolves over time, and our perceptions are evolving at the same time. And the other thing that I think evolves over time that makes architecture different from other things is our tolerance of architecture, because architecture is always there. It doesn't go away. It's always there to be seen. You know, if there's we have a tendency to kind of accommodate ourselves to it a little bit, which I think we have to do as a gesture of protection. You know, if there's music you don't like, you don't listen to it. If there's literature you don't like, you don't read it. But if there's architecture you don't like, you don't have the luxury of not seeing it if it happens to be on your route to work or what have you. So we learn, I think, to have a degree of tolerance for it, which is both good and bad. It saves us from being crazy and angry all the time about how horrible everything is, which would make it hard to live. On the other hand, sometimes it can also encourage complacency, which makes it harder to push to make things better.
And as history sweeps forward, shall we say, over these buildings, it's buildings can change and adopt to new values.
Sure, really, they can. Absolutely.
So that in preserving them, we're seeing a lot of that in Oakland, for example, mm-hmm. where a lot of the older buildings in downtown are becoming restaurants and so on.
Look at all the old industrial buildings that have become residential lofts in San Francisco, in Oakland, in New York, all over the country. As manufacturing has departed from central cities, as they have become more residential as places, as more people have wanted to live in the city, which I think is a very good thing for our society in general, thousands of industrial buildings have been repurposed, most often to residential use, and very positively so. I mean, all that is a very good thing.
In the city, going back to mm-hmm. our original mm-hmm. discussion, mm-hmm. is where a lot of the good things are happening, but some bad things also. And you quote Lewis Mumford as saying, in a city, time becomes visible. Mm. And
such a wonderful, just, you know, talk about saying so much with so little.
Yeah, right. And is there anything we can add to that? I mean, to help people understand it if they don't? I mean, is the history becomes important, as does the change in the history, I guess. Mm-hmm, is what, mm-hmm. And it's layered and it's all there.
It's always layered. It's always layered. It's not an argument for preserving everything, of course.
Right.
In fact, if anything, it's an argument for making sure that historic preservation, important though it is, doesn't dictate every single decision that's made about planning and building cities, because of the various one of the layers of time that we have to make sure is still visible is the present, of course. You know, a city is not a theme park. A city is not a make-believe place. And beautiful though the buildings of the past can be, essential as they are for our ongoing life, we don't want a city that consists only of them either. And so layering involves integrating the present and the past effectively, I think.
We went through a period, and you've written about it, in which the cities were deteriorating. They, mm-hmm. The suburb was seen as the ideal model. Is that direction changing now? And what are the positive forces that are making the city more viable again?
I think we have a generation now in their, let's say, 30s and 40s, who are more attuned to urban life than a generation or two before them, than their parents or grandparents might have been. I think we have, they're somewhat more sophisticated, they're more interested. The rise of the food culture is in part, not entirely, but in large part also closely tied with a kind of rise in urban culture in this country. And there's a sense of sort of more sophistication. I mean, something as simple as a farmer's market is an indication of a different set of attitudes about cities. All of that is good. I think the greatest problem is that too much success of this has raised the market such that a lot of people are being squeezed out. And that's a tough thing. I mean, I spoke in the lecture yesterday about remembering how at the beginning of my career, you know, a journalist could buy a big apartment in New York and raise a family there. Well, you know, that doesn't work that way anymore. And that's a tragic loss because we are losing a degree of diversity in cities that is part and parcel of what cities should be about. You know, in every, as I like to say sometimes, in every silver lining there is a cloud. And in fact, the fundamentally good thing about the renewal of cities that we've lived through in the last generation and continue to live through, the revival of Oakland, the huge improvements in so many other cities and the desire for downtown living on the part of a much broader segment of the population than before, all of that is a fundamentally good thing for our society, but it comes at a price. And the price is that it's becoming harder and harder to keep those communities diverse. The creative people who ostensibly are at the vanguard of some of these changes are themselves being squeezed out. I'm going to talk about that in the other lecture. It's a huge problem in San Francisco. It's a huge problem in a lot of places. But we also have to remember that much of the revival of Oakland, not all of it, but much of it, has come about because of people who could not afford to live in San Francisco or Berkeley, who might otherwise have chosen those places. A generation ago would have chosen those places. So within all of this is both a reminder that cities are living places and there is ebb and flow all the time, and that there is, you know, to use that word that all the tech people like so much, there is disruption that has both good and bad sides.
One final question.
Sure.
If students were to watch this interview, what advice would you give them with regard to preparing for the future? And they see as architectural criticism an element of that, but they also are committed to values that say, let's change the world and make it better.
I would like to hope that an architecture critic can change the world. I'm not so naive as to believe that it's all that easy or that an architecture critic can change the world that much. But I'd like to hope that arguing for better architecture is part of what has brought about, let's say, a more sophisticated, more visually literate generation, because they've been exposed to more writing and more public discourse about some of these issues. And we want that to continue. For a student, it's a tough time because we have a paradox. We have greater interest in the issues of architecture, planning, design, preservation, urbanism than ever before, I think. That's the good side. We have journalism and the vehicles through which this discourse can take place in a lot of chaos and disarray and dramatically evolving, and nobody really knows how the pieces are going to fall together. There are great opportunities for a younger critic to be seen and heard through blogs, and I think, but one can also disappear in that world of the internet very easily. And so in architecture, as in almost all of journalism, all that stuff is still shaking out, and it's going to be a long time before whatever new pattern it sets is fully there.
Paul, on that note, thank you very much for being on our program. And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.